We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments and insight. Professor of Political Science with Bursitz University, Saad Nim, joined us from Ramallah. And political analyst Ali Al-Faraj joined us from Birmingham with their comments and insight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذي الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
American voters are in a state of high anxiety with the U.S. presidential election outcome still unsettled amid allegations of fraud. Meanwhile, Joe Biden says he is confident of winning the presidential race while his Republican rival questions the integrity of Tuesday's election. France registering over 40,000 additional cases of coronavirus and nearly 400 new deaths from the pandemic. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, Americans are grappling with anxiety, fear, and optimism as votes in the presidential election continue to be counted with the outcome still unclear. The polls, or the last polls, closed more than 24 hours ago. However, the race is still too close to be called. Democratic candidate Joe Biden has so far secured 264 electoral votes, while incumbent president Donald Trump has grabbed 214. A candidate needs to win 270 electoral ballots to become president. The two are trailing one another in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Georgia, which are crucial swing states. Biden says he is getting enough votes to win the White House.
And now, after a long night of counting, it's clear that we're winning enough states to reach 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency. I'm not here to declare that we've won, but I am here to report when the count is finished, we believe we will be the winners.
Biden added that he has the majority of popular votes all across the U.S. and that the majority will continue to grow. However, Trump claims there have been, quote, surprise ballot dumps in the states where he was leading. Trump, without offering any evidence, of course, claimed his vote started to magically disappear after surprise ballots started being counted. He accused the Democrats of trying to steal the vote. The president's campaign has requested an immediate recount of votes in Wisconsin, It has also filed a lawsuit to halt the counting in Michigan. As votes are being counted, protests and violence from supporters of both camps have erupted in several cities.
Enough state.
Protesters in New York demanded a thorough count of ballots cast in the election. They also called for racial justice. Police arrested at least 50 demonstrators after violence broke out. Clashes also took place in Washington, D.C. and several other cities. In Detroit, Trump supporters outside an election facility chanted, "Stop the count." In Detroit, about 30 observers, mostly Republicans, were also barred from entering a vote-counting hall by election officials who cited indoor capacity restrictions. Many of those included, or I should say excluded, stood outside the hall voicing their anger. Many have raised fears that militia groups supporting the president may cause violence and chaos. Biden supporters expressed heightened fears the Republican incumbent might not accept the election result if he were to lose. Well, let's get you some updates through our man, Colin Campbell, standing by for us to tell us what he's been hearing on that particular story. Colin, I'm going to hand it over to you, please.
Yeah, so what we're learning is that these protesters are upset about the way that the votes are being counted, and they believe that there is some impropriety when it comes to the election count. Now, of course, this comes after the news that the election or that state may be going towards the former vice president, and that would definitely confirm that he would become the next president because of the threshold of votes that he needs. Now, there are some projections that the vice president has already won this state, but what I'm saying is to call this state officially for the former vice president would just really put him just a whisker away from gaining all of the Electoral College votes that he needs in order to win. And so these groups are part of these militias that we've been talking about over the past few weeks that exist in the U.S., some of them threatening violence, some of them threatening to kidnap the governor. Now, this is not the same group that threatened to kidnap the governor or who was arrested for their nefarious plot, but it's part of that same culture, that culture of this is our time to protect and preserve the government or democracy or to try to protect the president. And we have heard the president, if not so many words, call out to these groups to stand down and stand by in case there are issues that he thinks are threatening to his presidency. And what we're seeing is a manifestation of that. These are angry voters, people who obviously wanted the president to be reelected. And this is something of a dimmed hope for them at this point, as the former vice president is just a few Electoral College votes away from clinching the presidency. So we're starting to see a little bit of desperation from not just the president, but those who support the president. And a lot of Americans are a little bit on edge. If you talk to some Americans and you poll them, post-election violence is one of the issues that they are worried about. And this would definitely fit into that range, especially when you have a lot of voters who aren't motivated in that way into gun culture or violent culture. But you have a group of voters who do believe that carrying guns and maybe using them is part of their duty to defend whatever type of culture or preservation of tradition or convention that they think they're using their guns for.
You know, Colin, I really don't want to ask you prognostic questions, but I just can't help but asking you, because I know that you've covered such stories in the past, that are you surprised that this is happening in America today, and do you think that it's going to get uglier than it already is?
You know, I am a little bit, personally, I'm a little bit surprised. As a reporter, I get to see so many different areas and so many different cultures throughout the country over my time as a journalist. So as a journalist, you're not surprised by the surprising as much anymore. But as an American, who doesn't encounter this day to day, it does seem somewhat disconcerting that you would have a group of people marching around with guns and part of a democratic process, and something that you would think would not spur this type of emotion or this type of action. You'd also think that you'd have a president who would want all the votes to be counted, who would want everyone's voice to be heard, a president who wants to promote what Americans promote as democracy, at least from some of our high officials. America's supposed to be a paradigm for democracy where people are voting and that's their one chance to really make their mark in a national process. And it seems that not just the president, but these protesters want to upend that. Now, do I think that white nationalism is surprising? Definitely not. If we've known just how America was founded and just the struggles that many Americans who are non-white go through from generation to generation, we can see that white nationalism and the preservation of what some would call white supremacy is not surprising whatsoever. But it is very interesting that we haven't seen this type of level when it comes to protests post-elections, and at least as far as I've been alive, we haven't really seen it to this level. And could it get more violent? It really depends on the countenance of the president, I think. Will he call for violence, or will he signal that he wants violent outbreaks, or will there be a peaceful transition? I'll tell you what, if the president resists, if he resists from relinquishing his position of authority, there could be much more grave situations going on when you have these people who feel that now they have to protect or defend the president in trying to secure this power. I don't think that's going to happen, but it could. And that's a very real thing, because you have some people out there who are really motivated by some of the implicit language that the president has been speaking over the past several weeks.
All right, Dr. Colin Campbell, I could go on with this, but I'm going to have to let you go. I got other stories to cover. But thank you very much for your time on that update. Attorney and former diplomat Michael Springman says riots over rampant racism in the U.S. in the past to indicate how American politics and people have gradually polarized. Take a listen, please.
They have had race riots, looting, and general insurrection in the state of Washington, Oregon, Pennsylvania, and here in Washington, D.C. over the last couple of months. As Sam Lozania had remarked, the issue is, will people accept the results of the election? And if it goes the wrong way, what's going to happen? And piles of bricks and things like this indicate that they're getting ready to contest the election in any way, shape, or form that they can manage. Just last night in D.C., they had a couple of, they were termed scuffles by the Washington Post, between demonstrators and the Washington Police Department. So I think that given what's happened in the past and the fact that they've resisted Trump for 4 years, I believe that if the election shows that Trump eventually squeaks out a win, you will find a lot of people out in the streets complaining about it violently.
Welcome back. In other news, the United States has reported yet another daily record in coronavirus infections, registering nearly 100,000 new cases. That's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Data show also that the country suffered more than 1,100 new coronavirus-related deaths in 24 hours. The U.S. is the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Nearly 9.5 million people have so far been diagnosed with the disease there. The country's death toll now stands at over 233,000. Europe is struggling to contain the coronavirus pandemic as numbers of fatalities and infections continue to rise across the continent. Italy has reported more than 30,000 new cases and 352 deaths in 24 hours. The country has ordered gyms, cinemas, and theaters shut and imposed a 6 p.m. working time restriction. on restaurants and cafes. Other measures include a nighttime curfew until December the 3rd. Toughest curbs have been introduced in the country's northern Lombardy region. The UK recorded 492 new fatalities and over 25,000 infections, in fact. British lawmakers have approved a month-long lockdown in England that starts as of Thursday. A senior cabinet minister has indicated that the lockdown could last longer, but Prime Minister Boris Johnson rejected the comment.
These measures, these autumn measures to combat the surge, will expire automatically, Mr. Speaker, on December the 2nd. And we will then, I hope very much, be able to get this country going again, to get businesses, to get shops open again in the run-up to Christmas. But that depends on us all doing our bit now to make sure that we get the R done. I've no doubt that we can.
Elsewhere in France, over 40,000 daily cases were reported, pushing the total infections to over 1.5 million. Total death toll in the country has risen to over 38,000. Russia announced a record daily number of infections with nearly 20,000 new cases, 389 deaths in 24 hours. Poland registered over 24,000 new infections and 373 deaths, both of which are new records. The Polish government says most shopping malls, as well as theaters, cinemas, and museums, will be closed to combat the pandemic. The European Union has condemned Turkey's recent announcement to expand its seismic survey in the East Mediterranean. In a statement to EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell described Turkey's extension of gas exploration mission in the disputed waters as deeply regrettable. Mr. Borrell warned that such a move will create more tension and distrust in the region. He also called for a dialogue in good faith to reduce tensions. Greece and Turkey have been at odds since August when Ankara sent a research ship to the eastern Mediterranean. Athens then called it a violation of Greek territorial waters and requested the EU to impose sanctions on Turkey. The EU will decide on whether to take anti-Turkey measures in its summit next month. A UK family is calling for justice have held a rally asking for accountability and justice over deaths in the country's police custody. Our UK correspondent Richard Sudan reports.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it, they had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, you do know this is all self-inflicted, you do know that he did this to himself. And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
The justification for black deaths in custody and the rationale behind it, you know, is all developed within the sort of racist context of a white privilege that assumes that white people can never be guilty of any sin when it comes to inflicting violence against black people. And that's an attitude and a lived experience we've lived with since we were on the plantations, you know, way back in the 17th century. And it's continued from that day right up until this day.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold.
Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
Israeli forces have demolished the homes of nearly 800 Palestinian Bedouins in the occupied West Bank in a late-night operation targeting an entire community there. Israeli bulldozers, backed by soldiers, tore down tents and sheds in the village of Humsa al-Baghia in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli military claims the structures were built illegally in a firing zone. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatayeh has slammed Israel for making dozens of people homes under the false pretext, I would imagine. Bedouin communities who live in the area for generations not only face demolition of their homes, but hardly get construction permits. Israeli authorities usually demolish homes in the occupied territories with the Palestinians, which the Palestinians say are part of the regime's land grab policy. And that's it with international news.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. Many are informal workers whose livelihoods have been thrown into disarray. This has led to rising demand for assistance, even in countries that have offered refugees sanctuary for decades. He expressed concern about the pandemic's impact on women and girls, as illustrated by increasing reports of gender-based violence, adding that refugee girls cannot return to school without catch-up learning strategies or water, sanitation, and hygiene programs. We have prepared for you an article which appeared on the front page of UN.org website under the heading UNHCR Chief Says for World's 80 Million Displaced International Aid Life-Saving. Please stay with us for more of UN.org's article. Delegates discussed tackling ever-proliferating humanitarian crises amid an unprecedented emergency. Filippo Grandi, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, told the UN Third Committee on Social, Humanitarian and Cultural on Tuesday, 3rd of November, international collaboration and a sustained, adequately funded response are needed to ensure the world's 80 million displaced persons are protected from the COVID-19 pandemic and its lingering socio-economic aftermath. Filippo Grandi said, although the pandemic was unlike any of the agency had experienced in the 7 decades of its existence, it galvanized into action, helping host countries step up their response by strengthening access to water, to sanitation and health, and addressing challenges relating to mental health and gender-based violence. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, stressed as a result, major outbreaks have been avoided in refugee settings. However, he said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. He added, "This is why we will not relent in strengthening our preparedness." Whilst donors have mobilized funds to assist the forcibly displaced, he expressed concern about countries which enforce travel restrictions that block channels for asylum seekers and urged states to not violate their international obligations relating to non-refoulement. He emphasized international assistance is life-saving. Hailing the extraordinary solidarity that led to an influx of $4.5 billion in donations to the agency this year, Filippo Grandi pointed out that such generous humanitarian assistance is outstripped by the escalating number of refugees set in motion by the world's continuously multiplying conflicts. Grandi called on the UN Security Council to redouble its efforts to resolve political crises by reaching consensus on humanitarian issues. While safe, orderly repatriation is the most desirable option, it can only take place when peace prevails. Filippo Grandi called on states to provide resettlement assistance as Germany and Canada have done, adding, "I cannot hide my disappointment at the low levels of resettlement." In the ensuing dialogue held virtually, several delegates spoke out to share their experiences with refugee settlement, with some, including from Syria, China, and Ethiopia, noting that 85% of the burden of supporting refugees falls upon developing countries' shoulders. Others, including the United States representative and the observer for the European Union, pointed out that a disproportionate share of contributions to UNHCR were borne by a limited number of donors and encouraged the agency to seek out non-traditional sources to overcome its funding gap. Filippo Grandi said the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrates that challenges of such scale, much like the climate emergency, poverty, inequality, and forced displacement, require collaborative efforts to support the most vulnerable. The magnitude of the present emergency is unlike any that UNHCR has faced in 7 decades of providing underground assistance. Nonetheless, he said, the agency acted quickly, using an innovative approach to help host countries step up their response, including by strengthening access to water, sanitation, and health, and by addressing issues relating to mental health, stigma, and gender-based violence. He stressed, as a result, major outbreaks have been avoided in refugee settings. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, Filippo Grandi, said many refugees live within communities rather than camps, where they are additionally impacted by the pandemic of poverty. Many are informal workers whose livelihoods have been thrown into disarray. This has led to rising demand for assistance even in countries that have offered refugees sanctuary for decades. He expressed concern about the pandemic's impact on women and girls, as illustrated by increasing reports of gender-based violence, adding that refugee girls cannot return to school without catch-up learning strategies or water, sanitation, and hygiene programs. Turning to humanitarian assistance, Filippo Grandi welcomed the prompt response by donors to funding needs specifically for the pandemic. As much as 62% of UNHCR's $745 million appeal has already been funded, and more donations will be needed in 2021. However, he stressed, humanitarian assistance alone is not enough. Stronger social safety net programs and vaccination campaigns must be undertaken to mitigate the plight of the forcibly displaced and to relieve pressure in societies where they live. He welcomed the early involvement of the World Bank and the African Development Bank, which was a core element in the Global Compact on Refugees, affirmed by the UN General Assembly in 2018. He assured the mobilization of these resources is transforming the response to forced displacements. Filippo Grandi said at the Global Refugee Forum held in Geneva, Switzerland last December, as many as 1,400 pledges were made. However, the underlying causes of displacement, including conflict, remain unresolved. He expressed concern about multiplying conflicts because people flee their homes, including in Mozambique, Cote d'Ivoire, Yemen, Nicaragua, and the Central Sahel, where a complex situation led to the displacement of 650,000 people in 2020 alone. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, is also deeply concerned about the escalating conflict between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia, which can displace thousands of people in a fragile region. Filippo Grandi stressed that for the 18 million people who were forced to leave their homes, international assistance is life-saving. He called on states which tightened freedom of movement during the pandemic to uphold their international obligations and respect the principle of non-refoulement. While states such as Uganda have found ways to take in refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo and at the same time ensure precautionary measures are taken, as many as 67 states have not. He reiterated the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees' readiness to offer them assistance in tackling the complex challenges posed by mixed flows of refugees and migrants. Addressing these problems by reducing humanitarian assistance to those undertaking dangerous journeys, including by sea, or by externalizing asylum response is not appropriate. He stressed such measures taken in reaction the xenophobic rhetoric places refugees in unnecessary danger and threatens the global practice of dramatically needed asylum. While safe, voluntary and dignified repatriation is the most desirable option, Filippo Grandi said it is available only when peace prevails. He expressed disappointment at the low level of integration and resettlement in third countries and hoped they would increase. Highlighting measures taken by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to promote diversity within the agency, including the launch of a race equity review, he called a recent debate held with refugees who responded to the pandemic as doctors and community workers in their host communities and said their inspiring example counters the toxic narrative that often depicts them as a threat and a burden. In the ensuing dialogue, delegates shared national experiences and posed questions to the High Commissioner for Refugees. Many acknowledged the magnitude of the world's displacement crisis, with several underscoring the importance of burden and responsibility sharing in addressing the needs of refugees and persons of concern. Among them was a representative of Lebanon, who said her country hosts more than 1 million displaced Syrians, amounting to one-third of the country's population. 88% of them live below the extreme poverty line, compared to 50% in 2019. Lebanon now hosts the largest number of displaced persons per capita, offering a global public good. Guided by a human rights-based approach, its health system is available to all, regardless of status or nationality. But the country needs urgent help. Pointing to the sharp currency depreciation, the massive fallout from the financial crisis, COVID-19, and the tragic events around the 4th of August blast, she said, Lebanon cannot bear the brunt of the displacement crisis. Meanwhile, the representative of Syria encouraged the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, to improve its efforts to guarantee the voluntary return of Syrians displaced persons, notably by providing more financial resources and balanced attention to Syria's various regions in its humanitarian activities. He also urged the agency to work with concerned countries to remove their unilateral coercive measures, warning against politicization of humanitarian aid and the return of refugees. He added Syria intends to hold an international conference on refugees on 11th and 12th of November. stressing that COVID-19 has exacerbated the existing vulnerabilities of refugees, the representative of Turkey described the Global Compact on Refugees as an important tool for burden and responsibility sharing. She said, helping refugees is a moral responsibility. Two-thirds of the world's refugees are internally displaced persons, live in urban areas, and she asked about practical tools that municipalities can put in place, especially during the pandemic. Several delegates described efforts to support displaced persons, with the representative of Pakistan stressing that for 40 years his country has hosted the world's second largest concentration of refugees. Despite limited resources, it has maintained a compassionate approach towards all, even during the pandemic, including by providing equal and unhindered access to public health care facilities. Voicing concern about half the world's refugees are children, the representative of the Republic of Azerbaijan said her country hosts one of the world's largest internally displaced person populations. She asserted the 30-year-long military occupation of the Nagorno-Karabakh region and the adjacent regions of Azerbaijan by Armenia have continued to impede the return of Azerbaijanis internally displaced persons to their land. The representative of the Russian Federation welcomed UNHCR's measures to tackle the COVID-19 pandemic, underscoring the importance that access to vaccines is provided to all under UNHCR's care, particularly in refugee camps. The representative of Russia added that international community must not politicize the issue of the voluntary return of Syrian refugees to their homeland. The representative of South Sudan said his country hosts 1.3 million refugees, 87% of whom live outside the camps and primarily rely on government services provided in response to the COVID-19 health crisis. Along similar lines, the observer for the European Union expressed regret that contributions to UNHCR come from a limited number of donors and advocated for expansion towards non-traditional doctors, whilst the representative of Qatar said her country's contribution to the agency has reached $24 million in 2020, ranking it as the 20th among international donors and the largest among Arab countries. Looking ahead, the representative of Norway on behalf of the Nordic countries asked about the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees' outlook for 2021. Similarly, the representative of the Republic of Korea asked the High Commissioner for Human Rights about ways to encourage all stakeholders to ensure enough space for humanitarian activities and to reduce the risk faced by humanitarian workers on the front lines of displacement. Also speaking were representatives of Italy, Romania, Qatar, Morocco, Iran, Germany, Mali, El Salvador, Switzerland, Cameroon on behalf of the African group, Mexico, Canada, Ethiopia, Malaysia, China, Thailand, Mali, Afghanistan, Algeria and Venezuela. Whilst responding, Filippo Grandi said the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has developed a methodology that it is ready to share with states interested in reconciling pandemic restrictions with channels allowing those seeking asylum to present their claims. It has coordinated its efforts with those of other organizations providing sanitation, health, and shelter under the technical leadership of the World Health Organization, WHO. On resettlement, he said more countries must increase their figures following Canada and Germany's examples. He underscored his concern about the unceasing escalation of hostilities between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia and welcomed efforts by those trying to obtain ceasefires, including the Minsk group. To questions on the biggest post-pandemic challenge, he said he's concerned about the crisis of poverty and interlinked threats to livelihood and access to education. He said the destitution of the displaced and the financial challenges of host countries have the overall effect of limiting education access and increasing sexual and gender-based violence, as well as the threat of exploitation by traffickers and other criminals. He stressed, we must deploy all tools to counter this. To delegates calling for the burdens of host countries to be recognized, he said that throughout his tenure, He has stressed that the biggest contribution to the global good must be attributed to host countries, adding that the Global Compact on Refugees is built on this premise. Moreover, as many as 1,400 pledges were made by the recently held Global Refugee Forum. Of these, 400 have been implemented or are in the course of being implemented. Whilst the pandemic has inevitably caused delays, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is keeping close tabs on the rest of the pledges, which will be publicly updated on a dashboard. He reiterated his support for voluntary repatriation, adding that he can work with countries of origin to foster conditions for refugees' safe, voluntary and sustainable return, only if lasting peace prevails. He said whilst refugees have been included in pandemic response in many countries, this needs to last, adding that they must be given vaccinations when available and must also be included in the social safety net, which is more difficult financially and politically. This concern must be addressed by financial institutions including the World Bank. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has been in contact with them in this regard. Filippo Grandi, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, said the outlook for 2021 is not very positive, as the pandemic will have a lasting economic and social impact. He added that the stateless refugees and even returnees will require additional support. In addition, conflicts seem to be continuously multiplying, leading to ever-escalating numbers of refugees. In this regard, Filippo Grandi called on the UN Security Council to redouble its efforts to reach a consensus on humanitarian issues, which he has not seen it struggle to do in 30 years. Filippo Grandi said he counted on Norway, which will assume its seat on the UN Security Council in 2021, and hoped that all countries will find consensus when discussing the omnibus resolution on United Nations Human Rights Council's work. Filippo Grandi said, "Don't remind me to be apolitical." He added, "You manifest your apolitical character to approve it unanimously."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
This is News Bulletin. My name's Amina Taylor, and we're coming to you from London with this very special broadcast. Now, please stay with us. We bring you the latest international news, as well as continued analysis and insight as America decides if it will be 4 more years of Trump or a Biden victory. In the U.S., the election ballots and that counting continues. U.S. President Donald Trump has declared victory. Joe Biden's campaign has called this outrageous and incorrect while urging his supporters to be patient. Meanwhile, the world is looking on, wondering how the results will affect them. For now, anyway, Biden maintains a wafer-thin lead, but many analysts warn it's not over until it's over. As was expected, the blue wall will have the last say, especially Pennsylvania, Biden's home state. Bianca Rahimi brings us up to speed.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
I'm here to tell you tonight, we believe we're on track to win this election. We knew because of the unprecedented early vote and the mail-in vote, that it's going to take a while. We're going to have to be patient until the hard work of tallying the votes is finished. And it ain't over till every vote is counted, every ballot is counted.
Although both candidates seem confident, the race has been tighter than many expected. So tight that Trump has called for voting to stop immediately and threatened legal action if he doesn't win.
We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list, okay?
States are flipping, like Arizona, that has now gone blue. Unsurprisingly, Trump has captured conservative states like Alabama, Indiana, Kentucky, and Tennessee, while Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, and Vermont went to Biden. But all eyes are on the so-called blue wall states. Trump holds an early lead in all three, but the counting of mail-in ballots is expected to take days. All eyes are on the results of this election. So far reaching are the effects of U.S. politics. Donald Trump's administration has somewhat alienated U.S. allies, in Europe at least, pulling the U.S. out of hard-won deals like the Paris Accord and the Iran nuclear deal, and slapping tariffs on goods coming from the bloc. Biden has vowed to repair some of the damage done there, but as for countries where U.S. sanctions are biting hard, it might be too optimistic to think the results of the election will make much of a difference. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And I know he's been glued to the wires on this one because we spoke, I believe, at around 5 in the morning, journalist and broadcaster Ted Kofi. How are you coping? What's your reaction to what's been unfolding?
Well, there's only one word, and I'm not even American, but there's only one word that describes the drama of this election. It's emotion, because it's been rightly billed as a battle for the soul of the United States of America. It's very, very tough indeed. Once these emotions are unleashed, knowing that there are more dramas to unfold because it's going to take time to count all the early ballots, personally dropped ballots, and so on and so forth, it's giving the world a snapshot of who the leadership of America is and who the people of America are today. And it looks very divided.
Well, I mean, Donald Trump is clear this election is being stolen from him and his supporters, Ted Kofi.
Well, I mean, this goes to the optics that America is putting out about itself. More importantly, what the American system is allowing the incumbent president to do. This is giving a snapshot of American political culture at this time, and it's certainly not because it seems as if the liberals have been in denial of how absurd the situation in America has become. Of course, everybody knows that it's not over till every single vote is counted. But that the incumbent president can actually have the gall to come out and say that the election is a fraud, ask for voting to continue being counted in Nevada and Arizona, where he has strength, and ask for voting to be stopped in the blue wall, where it looks as if Biden is making a comeback in places like Michigan. There is a completely flawed logic to this thing, and people will be wondering how the leaders of the free world can conduct their politics like this.
Now, Ted Kofi, if somebody had substituted the word Jamaica for the United States of America here, and we'd seen these shenanigans taking place, there just would have been a scratch of the head and, well, it's a banana republic, what do you expect? But even with this record turnout, we're still having this problem?
It's probably because of the record turnout that these problems have been exacerbated. For example, what we've discovered is that that Trump has actually won more votes in every demographic except for young white men. Now, that's likely, but the beauty of that is that it shows what America really feels and thinks. And the message it sends out is how incredibly deeply divided the country is. One last thing, though, is that it seems as if age itself is becoming a vector of change as much as race has been in the past. Now, that's a significant development we're seeing here. If change is going to happen, people are going to have to look at the younger generation of Americans of all ethnicities.
Well, I'm glad you touched on that little point there, some data coming in. And before I move to that question, Ted Kofi, we've just had the news here that Maine, with 4 electoral college votes, has declared for Joe Biden. So another 4 in the kitty there. But I'm sure he's watching Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and so on a little bit more closely. So back to my earlier point. When you talk about the demographics in these elections, we've all sat through the past 4 years. We've all seen politics been done a little bit differently, shall we say, to be generous. But it appears Donald Trump has gained votes in every demographics bar white men. How is this possible?
Well, this is what led me to finding my quote for the day. Was a very well-qualified professional, made in America, black woman. And she said she felt betrayed because she thought that people who liked her actually secretly loathed her by this turnout, by how close this election has been run, and by the antics of the incumbent president. And it goes to this fundamental point that this is a moment for reinvention of America. Because Americans can see now, whatever anybody said, how divided they are. And maybe more importantly, the rest of the world is seeing what a deeply divided state America has become. And somebody has to go back to the drawing board and pull it all together. Because what is going on at the moment is unsustainable, not for a nation that aspires to be the leader of the free world.
Ted Kofi, wonderful words to leave things on. Perhaps more these disunited states than the United States at this point. Right, so we move on to some other news of events taking place across not just the United States, of course, but across the English Channel here to France, where police have been deployed around the country to ensure the new national lockdown is being adhered to. According to official statistics, a Parisian is infected with COVID-19 every 30 seconds, whilst a new patient is arriving in hospital every 15 minutes. France reported a record 52,580 new COVID-19 cases on Monday, while the country's COVID-19 death toll rose by 416 to just over 37,000. Similar records were taking place in Russia, where the daily tally of new coronavirus cases surged to a high of just under 20,000, taking the national tally to over 1.6 million cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Authorities also reported 389 deaths in the last 24 hours, a record high that pushed the official death toll to just over 29,200. And to Spain, where the health ministry has yet to call for that second national lockdown. The country is facing a deep economic crisis, with unemployment rising sharply each month. 3.8 million people are currently registered as unemployed, with a further 600,000 supported by the government's furlough scheme. And of course, the battle for the very soul of the United States is just being hashed out, not only on the television, but through social media. Robert, in Lakesh, take it away for me, because we were together here overnight trying to really have a deep dive into what the public were saying as that was informing traffic. But it seemed it wasn't just people on Twitter getting it horribly wrong. Tell me about Fox News.
Absolutely. It's a very interesting story that's emerged here about YouTube and the way that it's cut down on what it's called disinformation, misinformation, which was put out to the public. But it was caught up on that, for instance, Fox News had a major boost on YouTube. And this, of course, has opened up questions as to what actually constitutes fake news, what actually constitutes, real reporting and real journalism. You know, there are lots of different journalists' accounts have been taken down lately under the banner of fighting misinformation. However, Fox News was boosted, and there is a lot to say about Fox News reporting things which are just blatantly false. And so when it comes down to this, of course, it's not just YouTube, which seems to have favored Fox News being the biggest news channel in the United States. It has the most following in the United States, this being in favor of Trump. When we look at Twitter, for instance, and Facebook, it seems to be more in favor of Joe Biden. It seems to take a more Democratic Party line and censor information which would be positive in favor of Donald Trump. So when it comes to these big tech organizations, when it comes to these big social media organizations, YouTube, we're looking at a situation where at the moment they're manufacturing what it is that we're allowed to perceive as being real. And what does that constitute? You know, these people behind these organizations, many are saying, well, it might just depend.